This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. The Balkans is an extremely strategically important area in southeastern Europe. It's been the battleground for many wars throughout history, most recently in the Kosovo War in 1998 through 1999. It was the means by which Europe broke up Yugoslavia and grabbed this territory for itself. Well, recently there have been ripples of unrest coming from the Serbian population in that area, specifically in the Republic of Srpska, which is part of Bosnia and Herzegovina. The Serbs there are looking to declare independence, and making matters far more interesting, they're getting help from Russia. This is yet another theater where Russia is making moves that make Europe very nervous, very concerned, that are forcing Europe to pay close attention to Russia, even to accommodate Vladimir Putin's nation. This is an important story to watch. I think you'll learn a lot from our discussion with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about it. China has been making a series of moves to position its currency, the yuan, as a global reserve currency. Its latest move was this Monday. It announced that it would allow for direct convertibility between its currency and the Swiss franc. We're going to talk to trumpet writer Robert Morley about why this is concerning, how it fits in with a very significant trend that is certain to flip the entire global economic order. A recent United Nations report exposed a terrible practice that North Korea has been doing for quite some time in order to make extra money, that is, forcing its citizens to work in slave-like conditions in neighboring nations. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques is going to tell us what this teaches us, not only about North Korea, but also about the nations that are complicit in this abominable practice, and also why it's important for us to pay attention to these types of things that are happening in our world. And we're going to finish off the program today with a couple of tips on how to become a deeper thinker. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. One of the major geopolitical trends we at the Trumpet are following is the tension and the fear that Russia is creating in Europe. Vladimir Putin's aggressive moves in Ukraine and elsewhere, consolidating his power way back in 2004, our editor-in-chief wrote an article about this and about a biblical prophecy about how tidings out of Asia would trouble the Europeans and would really be a major catalyst for Europe uniting. Well, an interesting situation is developing in the Balkans, and it's essentially another front where Russia's moves are causing grave concern to Europeans. I have trumpet writer Richard Palmer here to talk about what's happening in the Balkans. He's written an article about this in the coming a print edition for the Trumpet magazine. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's start by, if you could just give us some of the recent events that are turning the Balkans into a potential battleground.
Certainly. Well, firstly, the Balkans is fairly similar to a lot of other areas on the Russian periphery, even though it is a good distance from Russia. So there's nations there that used to be very strongly under Russian influence who are now being brought more and more towards the European Union, more and more towards NATO. So just about all of the Balkan countries, even Serbia now is on the path towards EU membership. And Montenegro even is trying to push for NATO membership. But Russia is pushing back. Montenegro has these big protests, largely against government corruption, but they're also against the government that is pro-NATO. But the biggest pushback is coming in the Republika Srpska. And this is basically half of the state of Bosnia, Bosnia and Herzegovina. This state was formed in 1995 as part of a peace agreement. And these two different halves of the Bosniaks and the Croats and then the Serbs and Srpska were kind of forced together pushed together to form this united country. And now Srpska is threatening to vote for independence and divide the country to cause the state of Bosnia to completely fall apart. And Russia is a huge part of that. They have very strong links with, well, Serbia in particular, in general, but then also with the Serbs in Republika Srpska. So their companies, the names that are probably very familiar as being key Russian industries like Gazprom, Cyberbank, Rosneft, they're all involved in, or very strongly involved in Srpska. More than that, the leader of Srpska, Milorad Dodik, he's been holding meetings with the Russians. And for example, one of the most illuminating was on the day that Crimea declared independence, Sergei Lavrov, who's this, he's been the Russian foreign minister for years and years and years, a very important and influential figure, was actually in Srpska at the time meeting with Dodik. So there are obviously talks going on about independence between Srpska and Russia. Srpska is holding a key referendum on November 15th, and this referendum would essentially establish de facto independence. It exempts Srpska from authority of the courts of the whole of Bosnia, and so it separates them aside. It allows them to kind of apply their own law and judgments, and it's Russia very much that has the influence in Srpska and has a whole huge amount of say over what Srpska does. So if Srpska keeps heading down the path that they're on and the path that they've set with this November 15th referendum, they will become independent. That will mean, looking at how violent the Balkans have been, that will mean war, and war that's not necessarily limited to Bosnia. And it's Russia that is the key to all of that. It's Russia that can speed that up, that can encourage that, or it's Russia that has the influence and the power to slow that down.
Okay, let's dig into this a little bit and just go back to the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. This was a united nation. Obviously, there are a lot of different ethnic groups in there, primarily the Croats and the Serbs. And Europe, it was primarily Germany and the Vatican that supported the Croatian bid for independence and began this fracturing of Yugoslavia, undermining the power of Serbian President Milosevic, and paving the way for this whole area to begin to come under European control. So Europe, they have this strong history leading back to World War II and before with the Croats. And so they're essentially, it's a Catholic-dominated nation, and they have this history with Europe, and they were really pitted directly against the Serbs. I'm correct on all of that history, right?
Yes.
So now you have the Serbs that are essentially having been basically had a lot of their power stripped from them by those Balkan Wars, which Europe really was the spearhead behind that, but they ended up getting a lot of the Western world on their side to undermine the Serbs and to attack the Serbs. They're essentially reasserting themselves with help from Russia now. Is that right?
That's right. And I'll start by going back, like you did, to the 1990s. And at the time, there was the British officials involved in the negotiations around what would happen to Yugoslavia. Because really, it was Germany that pushed for the breakup of Yugoslavia. Britain was against it initially. France was dead against it initially. And there's a British official at the time warned, and he said, take one look at the map of Yugoslavia and you realize that with the sole exception of Slovenia, the nationalities and regions are so enmeshed that there is no peaceful way of breaking Yugoslavia up. To support independence for the republics is to sanction continuous civil war. And that's exactly what happened. You could have almost called it a decade or more of war following that decision to break up Yugoslavia. And the situation that we're in now, because you've got all of these different nationalities enmeshed, there's no really clean way of dividing them. And so the way that it's been divided up at the moment is very anti-Serb. The Serbs have their region of Serbia, but there are also very strong regions of Serbs in other countries, like Republika Srpska in Bosnia. There's also a very strong enclave in Croatia, where actually, and I believe the Hague Tribunal in the UN has even confirmed this, there was ethnic cleansing carried out against the Serbs. There was ethnic cleansing on both sides of this war. But there's a strong Serbian enclave that's part of Croatia. If, with Russian backing, the Serbs were able to bring back all of these Serbian enclaves back into kind of a greater Serbia, you'd have a significant new state on the southeastern frontier of Europe with very strong links to Russia. So it completely redraws the geostrategic map of Europe, and it would give Russia, it would bring Russia a lot closer to the heart of Europe.
Okay, let's just, before we go any further with the current situation, what is it about this region that is so critical to Europe, and why did they work so hard to claim this territory through the Balkan Wars?
Two reasons. The first, and I'll paraphrase George Friedman in his book Flashpoints, which quite a few times on this program, where he talks about how the Balkans is an area of land where empires pass through but seldom stay. It's a very significant, geographically, a very significant place. It's on the coast of the Adriatic. But it's time and time again in history, you had empires kind of clash across the Balkans. So you'd have the Ottomans came up there. Anybody coming up from the Middle East into Europe would tend to come through the Balkans. Anyone from Europe going to the Middle East, unless via land, again, coming back down through the Balkans. So there were clashes with the Ottomans, the Austro-Hungarian empires. And then you had the links with the Russian Empire in there. He cites a few more examples in that book. So just geographically, it is very important real estate. And if you can control the Balkans, it's key for controlling passage along to a lot of important places. And even if you look at a map of Europe, if you imagine the Balkans not there or as part of hostile territory or what have you, you kind of have Greece as an EU member is left almost dangling on its own with no land connection to the rest of Europe. And Greece, historically, geographically, very important. We did a whole segment on this program several months ago about that. But it's really about building that eastern leg of Europe. A second reason for its importance is historically you've had strong links between the Serbs and between this region of Yugoslavia and the Balkans and Russia. They have strong cultural and historic links, but then beyond that, there's a strong incentive for the two to work together. Russia is usually far enough away from that region that they're not any type of a threat. And then Russia has this great opportunity to cause trouble for European empires and to project power close to European empires by forming alliances with people in this region. So I think another reason for Europe getting involved down in Yugoslavia was you had borders were changing, the Cold War was ending, the Iron Curtain was coming down, things were in flux, relations between Yugoslavia and Russia were warming up, returning to their historical norm. And so here was an opportunity for Germany to eliminate a very strong potential forward base of Russia's. And so they went in there, and if they hadn't, imagine from Europe's point of view, if the Ukraine crisis was going on right now, but if Yugoslavia was still intact and still within Russia and was within Russia's orbit, instead of it being Poland, Latvia, Lithuania worried about Russian aggression, it would be Austria and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason for getting in there.
It's fascinating history because when we covered the Balkan Wars and, there was actually the point where the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, called Yugoslavia basically the first conquest of World War III. It was Europe's conquest of Yugoslavia. But I just don't remember Russia entering into the equation or, say, viewing this territory as a real battleground between Russia and Europe. You're talking about history. I was just not as familiar with this aspect of the history, but it really is turning into a battleground between these two powers that we've been really watching closely for evidence of this conflict rising up between them.
See, you didn't hear the story about how Michael Jackson stopped World War III?
I don't recall that.
No, it's There was an Britain's top general, or one of his top general, he went on, I think, to become Britain's top general, was called Michael Jackson, or General Sir Mike Jackson. And there's some famous pop singer who was either, who... anyway, he sang You're Beautiful, that terrible song from ages ago, famous.
Yes, James Blunt.
James Blunt, there we go. He was under him. And he's talked about this story a bit. But anyway, they were ordered by their NATO, their American commander, to go and take an airfield in Kosovo. But the Russians were already there. And they were ordered to go clear the Russians out. And General Sir Mike Jackson turned around to his American commander and said, "I'm not starting World War III for you." And that's how Michael Jackson stopped World War III. But even back then, more so, less so with the breakup initially of Croatia, and you, because I think Russia was collapsing internally. It was the early 90s. It was right. A huge time of turmoil for them. They didn't really have the wherewithal to oppose that. But when it came to Kosovo, they were quite opposed to that. And it's something that Putin has come back to and reminded the world of time and time again.
Yeah, that's a whole other interesting dimension to this, just the fact that Putin has drawn attention to the hypocrisy demonstrated by Europe and the West in how they illegally broke up Yugoslavia, and how there were just the way that they went about what they did was so wrong. It was so contrary to international norms and international law in so many ways, and yet Europe has complained about what Putin has done in Ukraine, some of these other theaters. And he says, basically, I'm playing by the rules that you set back in the 90s.
Exactly. And that's something actually that we also get into in this article, is he not just points out the hypocrisy, but he takes advantage of it. Because like you said, it did go against international norms, and it started creating new precedents in international law, etc. And really, Europe is based upon those same international norms and just ways of doing things. All the borders in Europe and everything are based on exactly the same principles that they undermined in Kosovo. And so therefore, Putin is just kind of really pointing at this and just trying to aggravating it, trying to make it as big as possible, because it undermines the very foundations of modern Europe. And so that's one of the reasons why he keeps coming back to this and back to the same principle. And so, for example, in Crimea, he said, well, this is no different to what you did in Kosovo. But as I talk about in this article, if you start saying we're going to redraw borders along ethnic lines like they did in Yugoslavia, that causes huge problems in Europe, because Europe's borders don't make sense when it comes to borders being drawn along ethnic lines. And when we talked about this, when we did on the Week in Review a few weeks ago, we talked about how that ended in World War II. But what I'd kind of forgotten about when we talked about it then was really the whole interwar period between 1919, 1918, and 1939 for this region of the world and for Eastern Europe in general were actually really, really violent before even World War II came along, because the principle back then was redrawing borders along ethnic lines. And this just took the lid off a whole load of ethnic nationalism, and it spilled over into these really violent conflicts. These conflicts were never really solved. For example, you've still got large minorities of Hungarians living in Romania, but just at the end of World War II, it was decided that's so destructive, we're going to abandon this idea of ethnic nationalism and ethnic self-determination for Europe. We'll just keep the borders as they are. They went against that in Kosovo, and Putin has a not just a personal pride from rubbing Europe's nose in it, but the opportunity to do tremendous damage by rubbing Europe's nose in it.
So briefly, as we conclude, where do you see this situation going?
Yeah, this is a rather boring bit, because to be honest, I think that the threat that Putin poses in the Balkans is so grave and so severe to Europe that I expect they will cave, or they'll do business with him, at least in the short term. So I absolutely do think they'll start working hard to undermine his influence within Serbia, to undermine his influence within Srpska. Perhaps we'll see the EU has one of Germany's largest foreign military deployments, for example, is within Kosovo. Europe as a whole has a lot of peacekeeping quote-unquote, troops throughout the Balkans. They've been drawing those down for some years. They may start trying to dial that back up again. They'll certainly do all they can to undermine Putin, but I don't think they can't afford an all-out war in the Balkans right now. So I think they'll be willing to do business with Putin to stop that from happening. And really, that captures the entire Russia-Europe relation. I mean, that's kind of where we started this segment. And it's that relationship in microcosm in the Balkans. There's a lot of fear from Europe, but there's also a lot of incentive for Europe to do business with Russia. So what you'll probably see is them doing business and at the same time preparing to defend against or confront Russia in the future.
Something akin to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And we've been talking about the possibility or the probability of something like that coming up again, just because Europe is trying to find a way to use diplomacy to shore up its eastern frontier while it prepares for war making and conquest.
Exactly. And back then you had the incentives were so strong for the two to work together that you had Nazism and communism, these two vehemently opposed ideologies coming together and signing a peace treaty that nobody thought they could ever sign. So the same geography is still the case today. A lot of the same interlinks are still there. So there's still a very strong incentive for any ambitious European power to come to some kind of arrangement, at least in the short term, with Russia.
Well, very interesting situation we'll have to keep our eye on. This is Richard Palmer that we're talking to. He's written an article for the coming issue of The Trumpet. The working title at this point, Will Putin Blow Up the Balkans? You can watch for this article on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Richard, for your time.
My pleasure.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
On Monday, China announced that it would allow for direct convertibility between its currency, the yuan, and the Swiss franc. Before that, their currency had to be converted into dollars first. But this is one of several moves that China has made undermining the dollar, whacking away at the dominance of the dollar in the global economic system. Our October Trumpet Edition cover story was about how China is using its currency as a weapon in a war against the dollar. I have with me Trumpet writer Robert Morley, who wrote that article, to explain this latest salvo in this war, what the ramifications will be. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
So can you explain the significance of this latest move on Monday, the announcement that they made?
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of the political and economic commentary out there is focused on just the fact that China has eliminated the middleman, the U.S. dollar, from this relationship. So now any trade that occurs between Switzerland and China doesn't have to involve the U.S. dollar. Previous to this, as you mentioned, any Swiss-based companies that had dollars would have to convert, that had francs would have to convert first to dollars and convert to yuans before that trade would happen, and vice versa with Chinese companies going back to Switzerland. That no longer has to take place. Now, a lot of people might look at this deal and think, well, Switzerland is just a small country. They don't use a lot of dollars anyway. So what's the big deal with this? Well, actually, Switzerland is really a hub, a financial hub in the world. And there's a lot more than just Swiss companies that are using francs. A lot of everything from the investment community to nations store their wealth in francs because francs are seen as one of the more stable currencies in the world. So there are trillions of dollars in this world that are stored in Swiss francs. So this does open up a huge potential for a lot of those francs now to be more useful in global trade and not have to go through and use dollars first.
And this is not the first time that China has created this system of direct convertibility with another nation.
Absolutely. This is part of a trend that we are seeing. This is a trend that we've been following very closely because it is part of China's attempt to make the yuan or the yuan a global reserve currency. And as you said, earlier this year, they constructed a similar deal with the British, with the regarding the pound. Earlier before that, it was with the euro. So this is just China's latest step to internationalize its currency, to make its currency used more intensively in global trade. And then thus, you know, as it becomes a more popular currency, as it is used and the dollar is used less and less, the yuan will start gaining a lot of the benefits. China will gain a lot of the benefits that America currently has as the global reserve currency holder.
Just a real quick, you've told us about this before, but reserve currency status, the kind of benefits that brings.
Sure. Huge benefits for America. Everything from our standard of living is impacted from reserve currency status. Things like interest rates. So if you're going down to the bank to get a mortgage, if you go borrow money to buy a vehicle, your credit card, all these things hinge on interest rates. And interest rates, the reason they're so low in America today, and even with our massive and growing debt in America, the reason it's so low and we can borrow money so inexpensively to finance our standard of living is because the United States has reserve currency status. So many nations around this world require dollars, need to use dollars for trade, that America can basically have low interest rates, and these nations still need to use dollars. And America doesn't have to raise interest rates to attract lenders and those sorts of things. So that's one aspect of reserve currency status. Another one is just America's ability to respond in times of crisis. Remember in 2008, when the whole global economic system was starting to fall apart, America was able to turn on the printing presses and print up, I think it's almost $4 trillion the U.S. printed out of thin air. And because people need dollars for trade, they're willing to accept those and they're willing to take those. And that really kept the system from imploding at that time. If other nations had pulled that trick, and other nations have tried to pull that trick, it would have sent their currency spiraling and losing value. Zimbabwe, Argentina, Russia, Turkey. I mean, the list can go on and on of nations who have tried to print their way out of economic messes. U.S. has reserve currency status. The world needs dollars. So America was able to do that. A second benefit, and probably one of the biggest benefits of reserve currency status, is just how much geopolitical power that gives the United States. When nations need to use your financial system, when nations are locked into your financial system and use the dollar, that gives you incredible power. Sanctions on Iran, you know, the United States was able to say at that time when they put sanctions on Iran, you can either deal with Iran or you can deal with us. You know, but you can't deal with both. The nations looked at America's economy and looked at all the, you know, they used the dollar and all the banking system, everything that flows through America. And the choice was pretty simple for them. We want to trade with America and work with America. And that's all part of having the dollar as a reserve currency.
So something that we've talked about, when you have a nation that's willing to basically print its way out of economic crisis, you do have a real pressure on the value of the dollar, and you have a lot of investors who look at this and say, really, it's the least worst option in terms of global currencies, and they want an alternative. And to this point, nothing has really emerged as a single terrific alternative, but China has really increasingly positioned itself to try to be that alternative to international investors.
They absolutely are. If you look at what China has done over the years, they're making huge steps to address investors' concerns about China. And you can see that they are working towards building the infrastructure that would allow them to have a reserve currency similar to the way the U.S. dollar works. And part of that is opening up their markets. They've been doing that. Part of that is making these bilateral arrangements with these other nations for currency exchange. And probably the next step that we are going to see is they seem to have come to agreement with the International Monetary Fund on working the yuan into what's called the special drawing rights, or this type of international currency that the nations use on the international level. Currently, it's made up of a basket of several currencies. The China yuan is not included in that, but it looks like at their next meeting that will be coming out in December. Looks like they're set to announce that China will be included in this basket of currencies as well. So that's another big step for China into making its currency available for use on an international scene.
Can you just remind us of the event that occurred earlier this year that was such a massive announcement that China made, basically, that it was going after the dollar?
Yeah, sure. China's made several announcements earlier on this year. One of them was the creation of this new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And this was a pretty big deal on the international financial scene. This was something that the United States had campaigned against very vigorously. They said it wasn't good for the world. It wasn't good for the Western world in particular. And it was something that really shocked America when, as it turned out, America's allies really embraced China on this issue and went against the United States' wishes on this. And beginning with the United Kingdom, almost wholeheartedly threw their backing behind China and their money behind this bank that China would oversee and would be the dominant shareholder in. And these funds would be used to, you know, develop emerging markets, the nations around the world. And of course, as you develop these nations, what goes with that money that you're sending there is a lot of political influence and clout. And China is going to be the one driving it, with the West supplying a lot of the money behind it, along for the ride for the dollars they get out of this. But it'll be China that reaps the lion's share of the geopolitical rewards from this bank.
Watching this trend develop, it just strikes me that America, if they're not paying attention, and it's easy for people to assume that things are just going to keep on going on the way that they have been, that we would never, there is no significant threat to the U.S. dollar. But it seems like it's really easy to underestimate the antipathy that these other nations have against the United States and how determined they are to watch, to bring America down.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think back to the 2008 economic crisis, which originated in America, and some of the rhetoric we heard at that time, even from our allies. I'm thinking about comments that were made from Germany's finance minister at the time and others that, you know, said the problem, you know, the cause of this crisis originated in America, and we need to do something, you know, that makes sure that this doesn't happen again. And a lot of the talk was about, you know, regulating America's system. But we've also seen a lot of talk about, as we mentioned earlier, building infrastructure that's outside just this one system that dominates the world right now, America's system. And I think going forward, we're just going to see more of that. And we are seeing that, especially in China. We're seeing it with Russia right now. And I think we're going to see more of it in Europe, probably in the near future.
So many of the decisions that we've made, the policies that we've put in place, you talked about quantitative easing and our desire to try to solve our problems by becoming even more indebted. Eventually, the luck runs out. Eventually, the day of reckoning comes. And these are signs of that day approaching, that we've got to pay attention to these.
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, you could take a look at America, and many people do, and they see things like the U.S. dollar has been strong lately. It's gone up this last year. You know, it hasn't fallen. Yet China's making these moves that undermine the dollar. They're undermining these pillars of support for the dollar that keep the dollar in its role as reserve currency status. Now, people could look at the strong dollar and say, hey, everything is A-okay. They could take a look at the stock market, which has gone up over the last 4 years, 5 years, and say everything is okay. But look at the fundamentals. You have to go back to the fundamentals. And if you take a look at the dollar in particular, like what's underpinning it, we have mountains of debt. We have a manufacturing sector that is slowing down, that is losing out to China, that's losing out to these developing nations. These fundamentals that underpin the economy are weaker than ever. What's supporting it? Debt. And that really is an Achilles heel for America. And when things like reserve currency status of the dollar start being questioned, the dollar's status start being questioned, that tower of debt could come down very, very quickly. And I think in particular with the dollar's value this year, so much of that strength is simply speculation based off of the fact that people are anticipating the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates from 0%. And, you know, the Federal Reserve has put this off and put this off and put this off because it said, you know, the economy can't handle it. Well, now people are thinking, okay, they're finally going to have to do this. And, you know, there's trillions of dollars in the investment community out there that look for these opportunities to front run these kind of things, to skim off just a tiny fraction of a percent. And that pushes up values of currencies. So I'm not surprised that the dollar has been strong this year. But when we take a longer term perspective, the fundamentals underpinning it are not good, and they are not sustainable over the long term.
So this we'll keep on watching this for sure. You mentioned in December the IMF making this decision about whether to include the yuan in this basket of currencies that is this international currency system that they use. It's something big that we need to keep our eyes open for.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be another step in China's plan to internationalize its currency and to challenge the dollar and to gain a lot of the benefits that America has. And as the yuan becomes more of an internationalized currency, that's going to come at the expense of the dollar, and by definition. So it is going to chip away. I don't think necessarily that the leaders in China right now, all of them, you know, see what they're doing as a direct attack on China, on the United States and on the dollar. I think some of them may, but they do want what the dollar has. They do want what we have here in America. That's human nature, and that's reality, and that's what is happening as China makes these moves.
And there's not enough room in the town for the both of us. Well, thanks for bringing us up to date with this this ongoing story. We appreciate it very much. The article that he wrote in the October edition is called Currency War, Dragging the World Toward World War III. Talking to Robert Morley about China's moves in internationalizing its currency. Thanks for your time, Robert.
You're welcome.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
North Korea, it's one of the most repressive, authoritarian nations in the world. It's also one of the most mysterious and secretive. Recent reports provided a glimpse into one of its sources of income. It's earning billions of dollars, somewhere between $1.2 billion and $2.3 billion a year, by forcing its citizens to work in slave-like conditions in other nations. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques has reported on this in an article on thetrumpet.com. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
This is a really remarkable story. Can you give us some of the details of what's going on here?
Sure. Yes, North Korea's catalog of abuses against its own citizens within the secretive country are really widely known. Those have been widely reported, like you mentioned. But this new report talks about what it's doing outside of its borders. And that is, it's forcing tens of thousands of its citizens into work camps, mostly in Russia and China, but also some Middle Eastern nations are taking advantage of this very cheap labor. And so the companies in those host nations, in Russia or China, they will be paying the actual laborers very, very little, or in many cases, nothing at all. But they're writing a big check to the government there in Pyongyang. They're writing a big check to the Kim regime. So this is a strategy that North Korea is using to get around the fact that it's got these sanctions levied on it that prevent it from doing business with other nations. So countries like Russia and China, who are willing to just ignore these sanctions, are helping the Kim regime to stay afloat and to make a lot of money just by exploiting its citizens in this just really perverted, exploitative manner.
So what kind of conditions are these work camps providing for these workers?
Well, they in many cases, they are forced to work up to 20 hours a day. And this is mining, logging, foresting. I mean, this is backbreaking labor for just incredibly long hours. They're under total surveillance, often with inadequate food supplies. So many of them become malnourished. And you know, of course, they're only getting a few cents to every dollar that the North Korean government is getting. Also, the North Koreans are generally signed up for a 3 to 10 year work contract. So that's how long they're stationed in these other nations. And one really fascinating aspect of this, I think, is that North Korea is worried about these citizens becoming kind of assimilated into the culture of the other country, Russia, for example. And so the North Korean government takes some really drastic action to prevent possible assimilation by its citizens. The work camps are like miniature North Koreas. The North Korean workers there, they all live in North Korean-style buildings. They have lots of North Korean propaganda fed to them every day. North Korean pictures are all over the place. North Korean songs, you know, they wake up and they sing the North Korean anthem. So it really is like a lot of just mini North Koreas. And then once they come back from their 3 to 10 years abroad, every one of these workers spends a minimum of 1 month in what's called a reintegration camp in North Korea. That's where they catch up on any propaganda that they might have missed out on while they were abroad.
Just a couple of questions from this. First of all, do we have any sense of how many of these camps there are?
I don't have a number for the camps, but research did show that there are an estimated 50,000 North Korean workers abroad at the various places. So I'm not totally sure how many specific camps those workers are in, though.
We didn't know about this before last month, basically just recent reports that came out about this. Where did the information come from? How did it get out? How can we verify it?
Well, this was from a United Nations human rights report. A UN researcher, he's an Indonesian lawyer, and he's been following this for several years. He actually did release a preliminary report about it back in 2012, but it didn't seem to make much of a splash. But then just on October 29th, that's when he was able to release a sort of a full report. And that's where all this information is coming from.
It's amazing to me just how the length that the North Korean government goes to control the minds of its citizens, even when it does send them abroad. But, you know, another aspect of this that I think is just very striking is the fact that the Russians and the Chinese would be so complicit with this treatment of these people. I mean, they're really going out of their way to prop up the Kim government.
Yeah, that's right. And the United Nations maintains that this matter should be tried in the International Criminal Court. I mean, it's obviously criminal activity. This is modern-day slavery. But the reason why trying to send it to courts would fall flat is because Russia and China are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. They would definitely use their veto to say, nope, that's all right, North Korea is okay, because they're benefiting a lot from this program. And they benefit just from having the insane Kim dynasty in power. So it really works to their advantage to prop all of this up.
What an insight into the mindset of these nations, not just North Korea, but Russia and China, the fact that they would be willing to be so much a part of this type of a program. In this country, in the United States, there are obviously a lot of people who are justly critical of companies that hire foreign laborers in slave-like conditions to produce our textiles, our clothing, and that type of thing. But the level of complicity is far less than setting up a work camp on your own soil, permitting the North Korean government to dictate all of the conditions of the workers, having those kinds of controls over everything that is done there. I mean, that is a deep level of complicity and a lack of concern for the well-being of these human beings who are right there doing the work on their soil for their own benefit.
Yeah, that's right. It's really shocking. And what they're doing, what Russia and China are doing by enabling this program, is prolonging the suffering of not just the tens of thousands of North Koreans there, but the 25 million North Koreans that live under this dynasty, because they are propping up this regime that is really the most abusive and incompetent government on the entire planet.
So In your article, you talk about a couple more levers that the government has to control these individuals that they're sending abroad. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah, I believe the most disgusting aspect of this entire program is in the criteria they use to select who they will send abroad to work. The main criteria are that the men have to be at least over 40 years old, and they have to have children back at home. And so the reason for this is that if they try to escape while they're abroad in Russia or China or wherever it may be, then they know that the North Korean authorities back at home have their family right there. They have their children right there. And so they know that if they try to escape or do anything else subversive, that their loved ones will be brutally punished or killed or sent to one of the terrible camps that you hear about there in inside of North Korea. So I think that that's just so sad and so sick that they use, you know, familial love against these workers to really bind them there.
It's easy to forget just how many people there are in this world who are living under these kinds of conditions and who are suffering on a scale that we really can't wrap our imaginations around. But it's important to think on these things. I think I'm just reminded of when Jesus Christ prayed, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The fact that conditions on this earth really are terrible and need to change. And we know that the prophecies of the Bible tell us that this is going to change, that there is a solution that's right around the corner. And looking at these kinds of stories just reminds us to have that kind of urgency and desiring for the liberation of people who are in these kinds of conditions by a strong hand from someplace, as Churchill put it, to be able to set these things right and to rectify the injustices that are happening on a scale of really millions and billions on this planet today.
Yes, anytime I start to feel, you know, possibly a little bit complacent with the world and start to think that it's not that bad, here in America, you can look around and maybe think that from time to time. But if I just take a look into North Korea, read a few of those articles, watch a few of the videos, read some testimonies from some of the people who have escaped, that very quickly reminds me of how desperately we need that global revolution that will topple that, you know, oppressive government and all the other just terrible, unjust, abusive governments out there.
We've been talking with Jeremiah Jacques. He's written an article, "The North Korean Government Earning Billions by Forcing Citizens into Slave Labor Abroad." You can find this article on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jeremiah, for explaining this to us.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
What is the quality of your thinking? Are you skilled at analyzing problems? Can you concentrate on the things you want to concentrate on? How deep a thinker are you? How we think is critical. Our thoughts govern everything we do and the attitude with which we do it. Thinking is the core of our being. Superficial, unfocused thinking produces a superficial, unfocused life. Our world is full of distractions, cluttering our mind with trivialities. Our overstimulated, technology-driven, information-saturated modern life is too noisy for us to hear ourselves think. Maybe you encounter something important and you think, well, that's great, I need to do that. I need to change my thinking, change my life in that way. But then you get distracted by something else. Our world is deeply hostile to serious thought, serious life-changing thought. I realize information is not the same thing as understanding. Of course, the stupid amusement that dulls the mind, that's a distraction, but anything can be a distraction. Information, even good information, becomes another distraction if you're not thinking about it, evaluating it, analyzing it, if it's not stimulating your mind in original directions. Distractions crowd our mind with inferior thoughts. Vigorous thinking is fundamentally a matter of replacing inferior thoughts with quality thoughts. If you want to improve your thinking, you have to turn the inferior thoughts off, exercise an act of will that creates some quiet and clears space for something of substance. Thinking deeply is a matter of restricting mental associations, so you repeatedly and purposefully mull a particular thing. It requires eliminating irrelevant thoughts, those musings that crowd your mind and pull you off the subject you want to be pondering. The Apostle Paul advocated such mental discipline. He spoke of bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. This requires a moment-by-moment awareness of and restraint over the images, impressions, and ideas that float through the mind and expunging anything unwelcome. That's basically what concentration is. How do you do it? Well, you may want a quick fix, but concentration is a skill acquired with practice, just like poor petty thinking is a habit strengthened by years of practice. If you aren't used to focusing your attention, you can't suddenly summon the knack. It requires habitual, concerted deliberation. But there is a trick to learning it. Here's a simple truth about how your mind works. You naturally concentrate on what you enjoy. In a wonderful little book written in 1929 called The Art of Thinking, Ernest Demne wrote, "Real interest is essential for concentration and creates it in an instant. The same boy who goes a wool gathering when he has to write a literary essay can concentrate for half a day on mathematics or on a new radio implement." So concentrate on those things you enjoy, or learn to enjoy those things you must concentrate on. At least you can consciously practice concentrating on the more satisfying things and progressively work toward applying the skill elsewhere. Demne advocated populating your mind with greatness. He wrote, "It's impossible to spend an hour in a room with a man approaching greatness without feeling the contagiousness of distinguished thinking." He said to read about great thinkers, read the writings of great thinkers. He wrote, "Our serious hours cannot be devoted to a more useful occupation than studying the lives or ideas of great men." And he threw out this challenge. If at any moment you are unable to name a great man who is or has recently been having an influence on your conduct, you will be passing the verdict ordinary on the quality of your own thought and existence. Who do you spend your time with? Their influence on you looms larger than you'd like to believe. Scripture is filled with admonitions like Proverbs 13 and verse 20. "He that walks with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." So find those wise men and women, and then really converse, meet minds, think deeply together. When you read, what do you read? What is the quality of the food you feed your mind? And just as important, when you read, how much do you think? Studying something to the point where it actually changes you requires letting it soak into the folds of your gray matter. Be honest, how much of your reading is forgotten the moment you stop? Yes, read more, but as you read less, think more. It's the road less traveled, but if you really want to change your life, it's the only route to take. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talked about on the program today. It's also where you can get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Robert Morley, and Jeremiah Jacques. Also, thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Adam Smith. Mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.